Everyone. I'm Alex Tabarrok, the Director of Research for the Independent Institute. The Independent Institute is a nonpartisan public policy research organization. Every year, we put out a number of books on economics, politics, law, history, and other topics. We have a journal, the Independent Review, and we host forums like this one, both here in Washington, D.C., and in Oakland, California, to help the public understand issues of public policy. In the landmark case, District of Columbia v. Heller, the Supreme Court ruled for the first time that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to keep and bear arms for self-defense. Now, Washington, D.C., however, is a very peculiar place, as many of you who live here know. Legally, it is a federal enclave. And in the context of that decision, it left it open how the right to keep and bear arms applies to other areas. So in cases like McDonald v. Chicago, the Supreme Court is being asked to rule on whether the Second Amendment limits only the reach of the federal government, or whether, like most of the rest of the Bill of Rights, it also applies to state and local governments. Now, I'm going to leave that discussion to our distinguished speakers. But I did want to comment on one aspect of the case, which I think is notable. These cases really indicate the power of ideas, the power of scholarship. District of Columbia v. Heller, it did not come out of the blue. It was preceded by decades of scholarship. Not lobbying or political action, though these may sometimes matter as well, but detailed and extensive historical, textual, and legal research into the history and meaning of the Second Amendment. And research which has bettered our understanding, not just of the Second Amendment, but of the entire Constitution. And without question, this scholarship, it changed minds. It brought many people who would not naturally favor or would not naturally be inclined to strong support of the Second Amendment, people like Lawrence Tribe, for example, to name just one, to change their minds, to nevertheless to recognize what the scholarship implied about what the Second Amendment says and what the Second Amendment means. Two of the scholars who have done the deepest work in the trenches on the Second Amendment are here today. Stephen Halbrook is the author of numerous books and articles on a very wide range of issues. I'm going to mention just two of them today. First, the Founders' Second Amendment. Now, I'm really a big fan of this book because it does what I think no other book does, which is to really put you in the place of the founders and their times, to make it clear what the events of the day, events like the Boston Tea Party, like Lexington Common, what they meant to the people of the time, and how the founders wrote the Constitution in light of their experiences. This is not a dry treatise. This is a riveting, popular, fun book on the revolution and its meaning. I also like to point to Securing Civil Rights, Freedmen, the 14th Amendment, and the Right to Bear Arms. Now, in my view, this is the book of the moment on the Second Amendment because it concerns the crucial question, which is before the Supreme Court today, whether the Second Amendment applies to the states or just to the federal government. It's also the book which I think forevermore places the Second Amendment alongside the 14th in the context of civil rights, and particularly the civil rights of African Americans. I should also mention that Stephen has three times argued before the Supreme Court and three times won, so it's pretty good batting average. Our second scholar is my colleague at George Mason, Nelson Lund. Nelson is a prolific scholar and expert, not just on the Second Amendment, but on federalism, civil rights, and election law. I printed out his CV, his 31-page CV, really puts a number of us lesser scholars to shame. In addition to being a tremendous scholar, Nelson has clerked for Sandra Day O'Connor. He's been an attorney in the Department of Justice and associate counsel for the president. He's also served with Jimmy Carter and Jim Baker on the Commission on Federal Election Reform. In addition to his scholarly work, he's a frequent commentator on TV and in the popular press. He is also the author of a brilliant brief to the Supreme Court on the Heller case, which I recommend to you all. So it's a great pleasure for the Independent Institute to host these two scholars today and to have them speak on the Supreme Court and the battle for Second Amendment rights. We're going to begin with Stephen Halbrook, followed by Nelson Lund, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions at the end. Stephen.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a real pleasure to be here to see so many familiar faces. And there's so many topics to talk about that it's kind of difficult to restrain myself. But I want to say something about Alina Kagan to start with. Back in the 1980s, she was clerking for Justice Marshall. A case came before the Supreme Court, petition for certiorari, named Sandage versus District of Columbia. And Alina wrote a very brief analysis of the case. This gentleman had been convicted of carrying a handgun, of possessing an unregistered firearm in the District of Columbia. And he asserts his, and she put in quote marks, right to keep and bear arms. Like that's something that, you know, it's fake or whatever. And then it just says, I am not sympathetic. That was her first known commentary on the Second Amendment and the lack of importance thereof. There's a couple of people I want to just introduce you to if you haven't met them already, actually. When Sandage was going up, I assisted the defendant's lawyer, and Dan Peterson, an old friend, wrote an amicus brief. And Dan, would you stand up? People can see who you are. This was back in the 80s, and neither the brief that I helped with nor Dan's brief could convince Ms. Kagan that certiorari should be granted, or any of the other justices for that matter, apparently. But it raises an issue that really is being dealt with in D.C. right now. We have a case called Heller, we call it maybe Heller 2 to be distinguish it from the first one, versus District of Columbia, and we are contesting the registration system. After Dick won his case in the Supreme Court, the district's attitude was, we're really going to stick it to gun owners now. We're going to make it harder than ever for people to own guns. And so they required not only that you register, but they mandated that your registration expires after 3 years, and you have to re-register, or if you don't re-register, you're a criminal and they take your gun. So, Dick, would you stand up? Most of you probably have met Dick, but thank you for coming out tonight. Just a couple of other things about our latest Supreme Court nominee. When Prince versus U.S. was being considered by the court, that was a case that I argued, and that had to do with the Brady Act mandate on the states that local law enforcement had to do background checks instead of the federal agency doing that. It was basically a 10th Amendment case. And it was anticipated, especially after the oral argument went poorly for the government, that they would lose. And so there's a memorandum which you can see in the Clinton archives now that is posted as a result of this nomination, where it's discussing different options. And there's a comment by another person that says that Alina suggests that we explore the president making it illegal for a federal firearms licensee to transfer a handgun to a person without a background check. Now, remembering that the issue was whether background checks being mandated on states and localities was a valid exercise of constitutional power, the suggestion was made that if the court rules against that and invalidates the mandate, as indeed it did, the suggestion from Ms. Kagan was the president by decree could make it illegal for a federal firearms licensee to transfer a handgun without a background check of the type that the Supreme Court just said was invalid. So just aside from the Second Amendment, can you imagine the idea of a president making something a crime? Like, I thought Congress passes those laws. And, I mean, think about that. This only, I think it was in the Post a couple of days ago it first came out, first became public. And I saw it going through those archives, and it just hit my head like a bolt of lightning that she would suggest that it could be made illegal to do something when Congress has not passed a law saying that, and the Supreme Court was anticipated to invalidate requiring local law enforcement to do background checks. And then the third thing that I think is relevant to our topic that she worked on very hard in favor of the Clinton firearm import ban of, actually it started in 97 and was complete in 98. Back under Bush 1, there was an import ban on firearms that were considered sporting, and the decision by ATF was that these guns are no longer sporting, even though they've been sporting since 1968, and overnight they became non-sporting. And so the manufacturers and importers changed the designs to comply with what ATF said was sporting, and then suddenly it was discovered in 1997 and 98, oh, they're no longer sporting. I mean, you talk about health care being decided by bureaucrats because they know so much about it. Can you imagine bureaucrats deciding what's a sporting firearm? Sort of the same thing. And so Ms. Kagan wrote the memo that Bill Clinton signed banning further importation of firearms that had been considered sporting for many years. So much for that issue. Let's do two things. Let's turn the clock back to the period 1866 to 1876 to Reconstruction and the development of the 14th Amendment and the whole issue of the black codes after the war was concluded. The southern states reenacted the slave codes, which made it illegal for African Americans to possess firearms. And one of the purposes of a couple of statutes that were passed in 1866 and then of the 14th Amendment was to do away with these black code provisions and to protect the right of all people to keep and bear arms. And that's the history, really, that's currently before the Supreme Court right now. After the Heller decision came down, Mayor Daley defiantly said that the Second Amendment does not apply in his city. And there were several lawsuits filed. McDonald was filed the same day as Heller, McDonald versus City of Chicago. The NRA filed several lawsuits, NRA versus Chicago, Oak Park, Morton Grove, and a few other Chicagoland suburbs. And all of those repealed their ordinances, especially the most famous one, Morton Grove. That was the first handgun ban, really, in U.S. history by a locality other than the D.C. one. And it had been upheld going through the courts, and the courts basically said, well, Second Amendment doesn't mean anything. And they repealed it rather than litigate it. They kind of looked at the handwriting on the wall. And in fact, the Heller case, even though it was about whether the Second Amendment meant an individual right and whether a handgun ban was inconsistent with the Second Amendment, also did a historical analysis that went through the Reconstruction period when the 14th Amendment was adopted. And so the court tipped its hand. The court began by saying that after the Civil War, there was considerable debate about the right to keep and bear arms and the ability of and right of former slaves to do that. And it cited the book that you can buy here tonight, I'll be glad to autograph, Securing Civil Rights, was cited under the subtitle, which used to be the main title, Freedmen, the 14th Amendment and the Right to Bear Arms. And the court goes into a nice analysis of the intent to basically incorporate the Second Amendment into the 14th Amendment so that it would invalidate those black code provisions and make it lawful for all people to keep and bear arms and would invalidate gun bans at the local and state levels. So the two cases proceeded. We ended up with just the NRA cases were Chicago and Oak Park and then McDonald. They were consolidated before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, and that was the same circuit that upheld the handgun ban of Morton Grove back in the 1980s. And the court rendered a decision very quickly saying that, gee whiz, this is not a very old right. Federalism is has existed for more years than the right to keep and bear arms, which was a phenomenal thing to say because federalism basically was in the Anglo-American experience was invented by the framers of our Constitution. There are no states in England. And the right to keep and bear arms really goes back to ancient times. Wherever there's humanity, there's people use, they make tools, they make have the opposing movement. Animals have their own weapons, their claws, their teeth. And humans are distinct in tool-making ability, and weapons are of defense are some of those tools historically. So, but the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals even suggested that the right to self-defense in your own home could be abolished, and therefore guns could be banned. It's a really, really wacky decision. The NRA litigants filed a petition for cert with the Supreme Court. The McDonald petitioners filed, and the Supreme Court ended up granting cert to the McDonald litigants and not to the NRA litigants, but the NRA litigants were still parties known by the weird name of respondents in support of petitioners. Something you'd probably really love me to talk a long time about those terms because this legalese is so exciting. But the bottom line is exciting. The case was argued in March. And I want to say just a little bit about the oral argument. I don't know whether you read any accounts of it or not, but I want to talk about that a little bit and then go into more of the history of the 14th Amendment, because it is an exciting history, and I'm hopeful that the court will go into that history when it renders its decision in McDonald, most likely right at the end of this month. There are two clauses in the 14th Amendment that are relevant here. The 14th Amendment says that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That applies to any person, and a person means an individual. It may mean a corporation like the NAACP or a commercial entity. There's another clause that says that no state shall deprive any citizen of privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States. And that's a more complex set of phrases. I think we're all familiar with the concepts of life, liberty, and property, the Declaration of Independence saying that we're endowed by our Creator with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And life, liberty, and property is part of that. The word right doesn't appear in the Due Process Clause, but it's presumed it's one of the premises of the Due Process Clause, that you have a right to to life, liberty, and property that they cannot deprive you of without due process. Early on, the Supreme Court basically rendered the Privileges or Immunity Clause something that that doesn't carry much water. And there again, I won't talk in detail about the Privileges or Immunities Clause because it would be really boring to a non-lawyer audience. But so the Supreme Court in the Slaughterhouse cases in the 1870s basically read that part of the Constitution to be very narrow. And it wasn't until the end of the 19th century that the court started saying that Bill of Rights guarantees are protected against the states through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. So the First Amendment, the Second Amendment being basically discovered by the court in 2008, it was sort of like the First Amendment was discovered by the court in about the 1920s and 30s, because there was very little case law on the First Amendment. But now it's become the most precious right of all, one would think, if you read the opinions. So gradually, one Bill of Rights guarantee after another has been incorporated and held to apply to the states, with a couple of important exceptions. The grand jury clause, that there has to be a grand jury to indict a person for a crime, and the clause guaranteeing the right of a jury trial in civil cases if the amount in controversy is over $20. Can you imagine that applying to the states? Every traffic ticket, you could get a jury trial, and the whole system would break down. Wouldn't that be cool? So those are two provisions that the court has said do not apply to the states. And the court has never ruled on whether the Second Amendment applies to the states, and that's what we're looking for. But there came a time when McDonald was before the court, there was a decision made by the McDonald litigants to rely on the Privileges or Immunities Clause. The NRA litigants relied on the Due Process Clause, which was the traditional way that the court had incorporated Bill of Rights guarantees. Now, when the when you argue a case there, or you see a case argued there, you'll discover very quickly that the justices are making speeches. They're not just asking questions. They're setting forth their positions, and they pretend to be asking questions. So you can really glean a lot from what a justice might say by the questions they ask. When McDonald's attorney was arguing, Justice Sotomayor, our new justice, said, "Well, if I rely on your theory that the Privileges or Immunities Clause applies here and the Second Amendment is incorporated through that, then we've got to incorporate grand juries and all these other things against the states." And these are not gun issues, by the way, these other amendments that would be incorporated if there was Privileges or Immunities Clause incorporation. Justice Ginsburg started asking, "Well, what are all these other unenumerated rights that don't have anything to do with firearms?" So there were, the court reacted very quickly against incorporation through the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And in fact, Justice Scalia asked counsel, "What are you bucking for a position in law school?" Because this is a favorite topic of academic professors about reinventing or rediscovering the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And Justice Breyer, who his questions take about 5 minutes. They really use up a lot of your oral argument time. He wanted to talk, instead of about the Constitution, about statistics and how guns kill people. And Justice Scalia said, "Well, this never comes up when you're talking about the Miranda warnings, does it? Like, if you didn't have to give those warnings, wouldn't there be a lot fewer people killed or whatever?" Then the NRA had some argument time, and Justice Stevens, you can see where Justice Stevens is headed already. He's wanting to say that even if the court incorporates the right, and he definitely would not favor that, couldn't you just incorporate it in a watered-down way? For example, there does not have to be unanimous jury trials, even though the right to jury trial applies to states and localities. And so where he's headed with that is, yeah, the Second Amendment could apply to the states, but the states and localities can still ban all the guns they want to. And Justice Scalia came back with that. "What about all these other rights that are the court's always recognizing that are not even in the Constitution, like abortion or the rights of homosexuals? And they're not watered down. Like, what's wrong with the Second Amendment? Why would it be a watered down version that would be incorporated?" The lawyer who argued for the District of Columbia did not have a fun day. Jim Feldman, he's a guy I met back in the early 90s. I argued my first case against him. And he was asked questions like the following. He made statements like, "Well, England and Japan, they're democracies. They have fundamental rights that are recognized there. So how could we say that it's a fundamental right to keep and bear arms?" And Chief Justice Roberts came back and said, "Well, we're talking about our system of fundamental rights, our system of ordered liberty, and not Japan's." So as you know, there's this internationalist trend in the court. Justice Kennedy made a very nice comment about the fundamental nature of the right to keep and bear arms. And the attorney for Chicago, squirmed when he was asked by Alito, Justice Alito, Can all guns be banned? Could Chicago ban all guns? What are you going to say to that if you claim that the Second Amendment doesn't apply to the states and to localities? So that's basically how it went. You could pretty much figure that the same 5-4 that rendered the Heller decision are going to go the same way. I don't like to make predictions as a lawyer, but that's kind of the conventional wisdom. It might be that more than 5 would vote for incorporation now that the right has been determined to be an individual right under the Second Amendment. So that's basically what we're hanging on the edge of our seats to be decided. And I'd like to say a little more, though, about the arguments that Chicago made in the case, and particularly their historical arguments. Chicago argues that it's okay to ban all guns for all people alike, and therefore there's no equal rights that are violated. They say that the 14th Amendment only protects the equal protection of people. Actually, I would say that would be the equal deprivation of rights of the of people. And as long as you, as all people are treated the same way as the slaves were treated, for example, that's okay. The right to free speech could be banned as long as you ban it for everybody. They don't say that, but they, since they say it for the right to keep and bear arms, and they say that was the only intended purpose of the 14th Amendment. Then the fun really begins when we start seeing the members of Congress who Chicago quotes without telling the court who they really are. There were the two leading opponents of the 14th Amendment in the Senate were the two main people that Chicago relied on. One of those was Reverend E. Johnson. He was really one of the great constitutional lawyers of the 19th century. It just so happened, though, he had represented the slave owner in the Dred Scott case. Dred Scott held that, gee whiz, if you recognized African Americans as citizens, they would have a right to free speech, to hold political meetings, and to keep and bear arms wherever they went. So you can't recognize them as citizens. You know, this is the shock argument. And so I think that Reverend E. Johnson probably had a good idea what the 14th Amendment was intended to do, because it was intended to overrule that decision, for one thing. And among the rights, privileges, and immunities that the court made clear in that case, of citizens at least, was the right to keep and bear arms. But Chicago cited and quoted Reverend E. Johnson without even mentioning that he opposed the 14th Amendment, and, you know, without telling the court that he's arguing against its adoption. How could you say that he would? He's the one you go to get your understanding of the 14th Amendment. And then there was Thomas Hendricks from Indiana, and he argued against the 14th Amendment and against civil rights legislation at that time. And he explicitly said, you know, in my state, we don't allow African Americans rights, privileges, and immunities. And one of those rights, privileges, and immunities in Indiana was the right to keep and bear arms. And Hendricks well knew that, because he was a delegate at the Constitution that adopted that provision in the state constitution. And he's the other main person that Chicago quotes and relies on for its argument that, well, nobody really understood the 14th Amendment to protect substantive rights. It was only about equality, and as long as everybody's treated equally badly, then everything's okay. Now, one of the most important speeches, though, that Chicago disregards, or actually they try to minimize, was by Jacob Howard when he introduced the 14th Amendment to the Senate. He gave a long speech, very interesting speech, where he talks about the fact that previously the Supreme Court had said this Bill of Rights does not apply directly to the states, and he talks about the intent of the 14th Amendment to make sure that the Bill of Rights does apply to the states, and he goes on to say that there are individual rights, privileges, and immunities that are before the Congress that are at stake in the proposed 14th Amendment, and he went ahead and read those that he thought were most important, and guess what? The Second Amendment was one of those, and he calls these personal rights. Now, this is the guy who introduces the amendment to the Congress. Chicago doesn't think that's of any relevance, but he goes on to talk about the fundamental rights that exist in every society that's not a slave society or a despotism. And by talking about the right to keep and bear arms as a right, he made that discussion in terms of it being a right and not a privilege and immunity of citizens, because he said it applied to the people. And his speech has been misread by some scholars to rely on the privileges or immunities clause. But in actuality, he clearly distinguishes privileges or immunities of citizens from rights of the people. And the right to keep and bear arms was a right of the people. And when he made that comment about slave societies and despotisms, he said that, what are those rights? Now, notice he didn't say that it would be a despotism or a slave society if you don't have a right to a jury trial in a civil case where it's more than $20 at stake. And he did not cite the grand jury clause, but he did talk about free speech, assembly, keeping and bearing arms. So this speech, by the way, was published on the front page of the New York Times, and and reprinted in a lot of newspapers. And Chicago said, well, you know, not many people read that, and it was a really long speech, and how would they understand all that? It was just too complicated. And it's right there in black and white. He says, he reads the provisions of the Bill of Rights that he selected as important, including the right to keep and bear arms, and he says that this amendment is intended to protect these rights from state deprivation. As you can see, Chicago is really, really stretching it and really on a limb in terms of they got some really weak arguments. You know, it's nice to go in court even if you have a kind of a bad case and you got some good arguments. But I mean, this is really unprecedented to go into court and basically on a 14th Amendment issue rely on the most racist members of the Congress at that time who opposed the amendment and to act like that's what the court should adopt as its understanding. Now, there's just an awful lot of people I could quote about the right to keep and bear arms at that time. And you got to get the book, and I won't bore you with it now, but it's not boring, but it's things like the following. You know how they always used to argue the Second Amendment only protects the militia right? Well, here you had the right after the Civil War concluded under the Black Codes, the gun seizures against African Americans were carried out by local law enforcement and by militias. And the Congress responded to that by banning the Southern state militias and basically trying to protect the rights of African Americans to keep and bear arms. And after it became clear that the states could not have laws banning gun possession, that's the point when the Ku Klux Klan came on the scene and they deprived African Americans of firearms, deprived them of firearms and basically terrorized them if they were voting Republican and committed various outrages of that type. And you can glean for the entire period of Reconstruction, this being a central issue, if not one of the most central issue of all. I mean, the Second Amendment was the only amendment mentioned in one of the civil rights type statutes that Congress passed in 1866, where the court referred to the rights of personal security, personal liberty, and private property, including the constitutional right to bear arms. They didn't say that about free speech or any other right. Now, Chicago is getting really worried about what it's able to do. They argue for flexibility and the ability to ban guns that are evil, in their view. And they actually made the argument in their brief that, well, if you say as a categorical manner that rifles, pistols, and shotguns cannot be banned because they're protected by the Second Amendment, what if Chicago needed to ban these rifles with scopes that in rural areas are used for hunting, but this becomes a favorite tool of gang members to assassinate each other, and there might come a time when Chicago needs to ban hunting rifles with scopes in an urban area, because they try to say that you can do things in urban areas that you cannot do constitutionally in rural areas. So there we have it. I'm glad they put that in their brief because it shows you what's going on here. We're in Alice in Wonderland. Language can mean anything you want it to mean. You know, an assault weapon or an assassination tool can be whatever gun you want to assign that term to be and therefore to justify banning it. So Chicago basically argues they can ban any gun they want to ban, and they're sticking with it. So we'll see how much they're able to stick with this. After the decision comes down, I would fully expect they're going to try to make things as miserable for gun owners as possible if they do lose the case, and we'll just have to wait and see about that. But keep tuned. The first couple of days of the last week in June, this month, June, and we should have a decision. So I'll stop there and turn it over to Nelson. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. It's an honor to be here with Steve Halbrook. I could easily spend all of my allotted time describing Steve's contributions to the revival of serious interest in the Second Amendment and giving him the praise he deserves. But I've been asked to focus on the Supreme Court's emerging jurisprudence, so I'll just begin with a couple of brief remarks about the significance of his work. When Steve first began his research more than 30 years ago, he had some handicaps that eventually turned out to be advantages. First, he was a practicing lawyer rather than a legal academic. Second, he thought that the Constitution means what the people who created it thought it meant. Now, these were they might not sound the handicaps to you, but they were handicaps because the court at that time had very little interest in the original meaning of the Constitution, and the legal academy had virtually no interest in what outsiders like Steve might have to say. On top of that, the courts and the professors universally thought that the Second Amendment was a kind of bad joke. Well, they're not laughing anymore. Eventually, Steve is going to get the credit he deserves for this remarkable reorientation of legal thought. Now, tonight I'm going to talk a little about the progress that's been made and about its limits. 2 years ago, as you know, the Supreme Court struck down Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban in the Heller decision. As Alex mentioned, this was the first time in history that the court has found any law in violation of the Second Amendment. Apart from its significance for the politically contentious issue of gun control, Heller was an important test case for the interpretive theory of originalism. There were virtually no relevant Supreme Court precedents, and certainly none that could be considered dispositive. Heller was also a good test case for originalism because the Second Amendment poses some genuine puzzles. Its text, for example, uniquely combines an explanatory phrase and a command. It says, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Now, what does that preambular reference to the importance of a well-regulated militia have to do with the right of the people to keep and bear arms? One usually thinks of constitutional rights as obstacles, not spurs, to regulation, and it's not immediately evident, at least to typical 21st century readers, how this right to arms could contribute to the establishment or preservation of a well-regulated militia. A different kind of puzzle arises from changes in the circumstances to which the constitutional provision must be applied. American society is dramatically different from the world in which the Second Amendment was adopted. The militia organizations extolled by the founding generation have withered away. And advances in the technology of weaponry have produced arms that are far more dangerous than those available in the founding era. That raises a question. Is it even possible, let alone prudent, to apply the Second Amendment's command to a modern society in which it could have radically different effects than what would have been expected in 1791? Now, Heller was a good test case for another reason. The opinion was assigned to the court's leading exponent of originalist jurisprudence, Antonin Scalia. Scalia makes a powerful case, based in large part on Steve Halbrook's work, for two important propositions. First, the right to keep and bear arms is an individual, private right, not a right of the states to organize militias. Second, the purpose of the right is to enable individuals to exercise their inherent right of self-defense, including the right to defend themselves against criminal violence. But that's not enough to resolve the initial textual puzzle about the relationship between the prefatory language and the operative clause. Scalia tries to do this by claiming that the right to arms was a pre-existing right and that the preface of the Second Amendment merely tells us why it was codified without changing the content of the pre-existing right. Now, there are two main problems with Scalia's analysis. First, he says that the constitutional text itself, which refers to the right to keep and bear arms, implies a reference to a pre-existing right. But that's a linguistic fallacy. You could write a law saying that the right to free medical care at government expense shall not be infringed. That would not imply that the right already existed. Of course, there was a pre-existing right to arms, and the Second Amendment could be referring to that right. But then you would have to try to figure out the scope of the right. In practice, the pre-existing right was almost unlimited because there were almost no laws restricting the right in America at that time, and none from the federal government at all. That's clearly not what Scalia means, because he later endorses a great many restrictions that did not exist in 1791. Alternatively, you might try to figure out what kinds of restrictions would have been acceptable if legislatures had wanted to impose them. But there was almost no discussion of such questions in the founding period because there was no reason for anybody to have such discussions. Now, the second big problem with Scalia's effort to deal with the prefatory language involves his claim that it merely explains why the pre-existing right was codified. His explanation of the purpose of the codification makes no sense. Scalia asserts, and here I'm quoting, that the Second Amendment's prefatory clause announces the purpose for which the right was codified, colon, to prevent elimination of the militia. Now, what he says here is just false. The text of the Second Amendment refers to a well-regulated militia, not to the militia. They are not synonymous terms, and Scalia himself acknowledges as much when he distinguishes between an organized and an unorganized militia. Building on his fallacious premise, Scalia claims that the Constitution assumes that the militia is already in existence and that it means all able-bodied men. Now, that's not exactly wrong, but it makes nonsense of Scalia's claim that the purpose of codifying the right to arms was to prevent the elimination of the militia. The nation's able-bodied men, which is what Scalia says the militia is, would not be eliminated if they or anyone else were to be disarmed. Scalia's argument also carries the fallacious implication that Second Amendment rights are limited to able-bodied men, which they're not. The most difficult textual question, which Scalia never even addresses, is how codifying the right to arms could have been expected to preserve, promote, or prevent the elimination of a well-regulated militia. Now, I believe there's a perfectly good answer to that question, but no answer of any kind will be found in Scalia's opinion. That is a very, very serious shortcoming in a judicial opinion that purports to rely as heavily as Scalia's does on textual analysis and originalist interpretive principles. Scalia's failure to identify any textual or historical evidence about the scope of the Second Amendment right has spectacular effects when he addresses the principal question at stake in the Heller case itself, namely, whether the D.C. handgun ban was unconstitutional. The court concludes that it is unconstitutional, but the only reasons that Scalia offers are that handguns are popular weapons for self-defense among Americans today, and that he thinks there are good reasons why handguns are popular. That is not an historical or originalist argument. If it's any kind of argument at all, it's probably a disguised and incomplete form of the quasi-legislative interest-balancing approach that Scalia disdainfully dismisses elsewhere in his opinion. It's very striking that Scalia abandons any pretense of originalism when he addresses the issue actually presented in the case. What's even more striking is that he also includes a series of astounding and unnecessary comments endorsing various forms of gun control that were not at issue in the case. First, he says that nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill. I guess that sounds reasonable, at least at first, but how longstanding have these prohibitions been? Scalia either doesn't know or he decided not to tell us. Apparently, however, the first general ban on the possession of firearms by felons was enacted in 1968. That's right, 1968. Longstanding? That was 177 years after the adoption of the Second Amendment and less than a decade before the D.C. handgun ban was adopted. Aside from the absence of historical support involving the pre-existing right to arms, the conclusion is inconsistent with what Scalia himself calls the core of the right, namely self-defense. On what understanding of that core right does it make any sense at all to leave American citizens defenseless in their own homes for the rest of their lives on the basis of nothing more than a nonviolent felony like tax evasion or insider trading? It would make more sense to say that these felons can be silenced for the rest of their lives. Regulatory crimes, after all, usually involve an abuse of speech, such as making false statements to the government or negotiating contracts that the government doesn't like. But they don't have anything at all to do with firearms or violence. Next, Scalia endorses prohibitions on the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings. Scalia provides no evidence that Americans were forbidden to carry firearms in schools and government buildings prior to 1791, nor does he explain what makes these places sensitive or how courts are supposed to go about determining the scope of this newly announced exception to the right to arms. Is a university campus more sensitive than a shopping mall across the street? Is a government-owned cabin in a national forest more sensitive than a privately owned hotel? Did the whole city of New Orleans become a sensitive place after Hurricane Katrina, thus justifying the government in forcibly disarming law-abiding citizens whom the government was unable to protect from roving bands of criminals? We are never told what limits, if any, there are on the discretion of courts to decide that certain places are so sensitive that Americans may be disarmed when they go there. And we're certainly not given any historical evidence to support such discretion. The Heller majority next endorses laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. Once again, Scalia presents no historical evidence about the nature or even existence of pre-1791 commercial regulations, nor does he suggest any limit on government's power to impose conditions and qualifications on these commercial transactions. For all we're told here, Congress could place a prohibitively high tax on the sale of firearms or create burdensome regulatory obstacles that would make it impractical for a commercial market to exist. If the court means that it would improve only reasonable conditions and qualifications, it failed to say so, and it suggested no criteria based in history or anything else by which reasonable restrictions could be distinguished from unreasonable restrictions. The court also endorses bans on the concealed carry of firearms. Once again, Scalia provides no evidence that such bans existed prior to 1791 and no evidence that anyone thought they would be permissible. Instead, he vaguely relies on some 19th century state cases. None of the cases that he could have cited provides any evidence about the original meaning of the Second Amendment, and every one of them employed interpretive techniques that the Heller Court expressly rejected. What's more, the two state cases that Scalia does cite relied on the proposition that only assassins have a reason to hide their weapons, whereas honest men carry their guns out in the open. Now, that may have been true in Georgia in 1846 and in Louisiana in 1850, which is where those cases came from, but it may not have been true throughout America when the Bill of Rights was adopted, and it is certainly not true today. Finally, the Heller Court announces that the Second Amendment does, and I'll, forgive me for the clumsy grammar here, I'm quoting the court, announces that the Second Amendment does not protect those weapons not typically possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes, and there are a couple of examples, short-barreled shotguns and apparently machine guns as well, which are per se not protected by the Second Amendment according to the court. Well, where'd that come from? Scalia invokes a 1939 precedent in support of his conclusion, but his interpretation of the case is really completely wacky. He also invokes William Blackstone's reference to dangerous and unusual weapons, but Blackstone did not say that it was illegal to possess such weapons, and he said only that it was illegal to carry them in public when doing so would terrify the good people of the land. Maybe the court will someday provide an originalist rationale for Heller's holding that a handgun ban is unconstitutional, a rationale that Heller itself promised but did not deliver. And maybe the court will someday repudiate its unsubstantiated endorsements of some very dubious gun control laws. Meanwhile, I think Heller will stand as a monument to a peculiar kind of jurisprudence, which might charitably be called half-hearted originalism. In a narrow sense, the Constitution was vindicated in Heller because the court reached an easily defensible originalist result. But the court's reasoning is at critical points so defective and so transparently non-originalist that Heller should be seen as an embarrassment for those who joined the majority opinion. Now, as Alex and Steve described, immediately after this decision was announced, several Chicago residents filed a federal lawsuit claiming that a similar law in that city violates the 14th Amendment. The plaintiffs relied on both the Privileges or Immunities Clause and the Due Process Clause, which they maintain render the Second Amendment applicable to state and local governments. This is the McDonald case, which the Supreme Court is scheduled to decide in a few weeks. The Bill of Rights originally applied only to the federal government, and that was what was at issue in Heller. With the adoption of the 14th Amendment in 1868, the Constitution put new restrictions on the states, including the two limitations at issue in McDonald. They are as follows, and I'll read them. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. As Steve mentioned, in 1873, the court read the Privileges or Immunities Clause very narrowly, holding that it protects only those rights that owe their existence to the federal government, its national character, its constitution, or its laws. Three subsequent cases during the 19th century applied that holding to the Second Amendment. In all three cases, the court found that the right to keep and bear arms, and other elements of the Bill of Rights as well, pre-existed the federal constitution. Under the 1873 interpretation of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, such pre-existing rights are not protected against state action. Shortly after the last of these three decisions, at the very end of the 19th century, the Supreme Court started taking a new approach. Rather than revisit its precedents, however, it started making some of the rights listed in the Bill of Rights, but not others, applicable to the states under the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. The theory underlying this process of selective incorporation is that the Due Process Clause imposes substantive limits on the government's discretion to interfere with what the court calls fundamental rights. The court has never even tried to derive this doctrine from the text or history of the Constitution. It's just something they made up out of thin air. Most of the individual rights listed in the Bill of Rights have now been incorporated through substantive due process, and a very few have been held to be insufficiently fundamental. McDonald is the first case in which the justices have agreed to consider whether the Second Amendment's right to arms is sufficiently fundamental to justify incorporating it under the doctrine of substantive due process. At the oral argument in March, the plaintiff's lawyer started out by arguing that Chicago's law violates the original meaning of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And who do you think interrupted to ridicule the lawyer for making this argument? None other than Mr. Original Meaning himself, Antonin Scalia. Here's what he said, and I'm quoting, "Why are you asking us to overrule 150, 140 years of prior law when you can reach a result under substantive due? I mean, you know, unless you're bucking for a place on some law school faculty." That provoked some laughter in the courtroom, and Scalia soon followed up with this mocking comment, and again I'm quoting, "Well, I mean, what you argue is the darling of the professoriate for sure, but it's also contrary to 140 years of our jurisprudence. Why do you want to undertake that burden instead of just arguing substantive due process? Which, as much as I think it's wrong, even I have acquiesced in it." More laughter. Now, judging from the oral argument as a whole, I think there is no chance that the court will decide this case according to the original meaning of the 14th Amendment. but there are probably at least 5 votes for striking down Chicago's law under substantive due process. If that's what the court decides to do, the immediate effect of the decision will be to apply Heller's interpretation of the Second Amendment to the state and local governments. Because Heller approved a broad range of gun control regulations, we should not expect any massive expansion of gun rights, at least in the near term. But a great many important questions will probably still be open for resolution in future cases, and I'm going to close with 3 examples. First, Heller endorsed bans on the carrying of concealed weapons, but said nothing about a right to open carry. In other words, carrying weapons openly. Because the Second Amendment expressly protects the right to bear arms as well as the right to keep arms, the text of the Constitution, it seems to me, is simply inconsistent with allowing the government to forbid both open and concealed carry of weapons. Such a ban also seems inconsistent with Heller's emphasis on self-defense as the core of the Second Amendment right. Most people are in much more danger of encountering violent criminals outside their homes than they are within them. Second, Heller endorsed bans on carrying weapons in sensitive places, but articulated no test for identifying such locations. Unless McDonald offers further guidance, the lower courts will apparently have to develop a sensitivity jurisprudence on their own. Who knows where that will lead, but there will be a lot of questions about it. Finally, state and local jurisdictions sometimes place very onerous administrative obstacles in the path of those who desire to possess or carry firearms. Such obstructionism may become more intense in those jurisdictions that would like to impose outright gun bans that the courts will no longer uphold. The Heller 2 case is an example, that shows that Washington, D.C. has already started down this road. Chicago is likely to do the same. Courts will surely face numerous challenges from citizens who claim that such administrative obstacles impermissibly burden the underlying substantive right. How the courts respond to such challenges may be the most important factor in determining whether the Supreme Court's budding recognition of the constitutional right to arms will have much practical significance in American life. To whatever degree the courts prove willing to protect our constitutional rights in this area, I think we will all owe Steve Halbrook a large debt of gratitude. Thank you.
Okay, we have some time for questions. Fran will bring you the microphone. You're going to switch the tapes. Okay. Let me also give you a warning while they're switching the tapes that I know there's a number of lawyers in the audience, so the usual disclaimer that we are interested in questions, not long speeches, will doubly apply. And since I'm sitting here at the front, I will take the judicial role. Hopefully, won't have to cut anyone off. Let me just give them a few more seconds to switch the tapes, and then Fran will begin with this gentleman here on the right once the tapes have been switched. So you want to get your questions for posterity as well as for our audience today. So just give me a shout when the tapes have been switched so we can go.